All right, it's time for us to begin our class. We'll be looking in chapters 19 through 24 tonight, if we can get through it. We finished up our section, or we are finishing up this section, this kind of third section in the outline that we provided about the book of Numbers and the disobedience and not going into the land and the wandering around and dying, rebellion. We talked last week about there was rebellion from top down, as far as everybody kind of questioning the authority of those who were leading. And we're going to see more death in the book of Numbers as we continue on through this, as a generation is passing away and there's new things coming on up on the scene. And so we talked chapter 18, we kind of just briefly looked at this, but the duties of the Levites and the portions that were for the priests and the things that were going to be theirs. And the tithe of the tithes, where the priests also offer a tithe of those things that they were tithe that they received from the tithe, and those went to Aaron, or his son. So we kind of looked at those things briefly last week, but just to give you an idea that's how God took care of the priestly order, right? And we talked about the difference between a lean priest and a fat priest. Right, that's when God's people were offering the way they're supposed to and feeding the priests. They were well taken care of, right? And when they were not, obviously they were lean priests, right? So that's the idea of the care of God, that God was their portion. So looking in chapter 19, we have the ashes of the red heifer. And I don't know if that's not a conversation piece that you guys have very often. How many of you know what a heifer is? What is a heifer? Female cow, yes, but not all female cows are heifers. What is unique about a heifer? Young and has not had a child yet. No, hasn't dropped a calf, right? No child, haven't dropped a calf yet. So a heifer is this one that has not had a calf. And so we're talking about this red heifer, and we have some interesting things that go on with this. It talks about the statute and a law that's commanded in verse 2 of chapter 19, this unblemished red heifer, never had a yoke on her as well, and there's prescribed what they're going to do. There's a certain way they're going to go take her outside the camp, kill her, sprinkle blood towards the tabernacle, and then burning this heifer with certain other items, hyssop and cedar and purple, and then collecting those ashes. What is all this about? Well, it becomes this sort of a cleansing water. So you take the ashes and you mix the ashes with water, and it becomes what's used for purification. It's what is used for purification. So we see that in reference to a dead man. So those who are now unclean because of coming in contact with a dead person, they take the ashes from the heifer, put it in some sort of vessel, pour water on top of it, and that is what's used with hyssop to cleanse those things that are now unclean. And so you are unclean for 7 days if you come in contact with a dead man. On the third day of your uncleanness, you are doused with, sprinkled with water that is mixed with the ashes of the red heifer. There is tradition says that from the date of this inception until the destruction of the temple, AD 70, tradition says that there were 9 to 10 red heifers that were burned and used, and their ashes were used during that time. So we're not saying they used a lot. They were judicious with the use of the ashes of the red heifer. So they would mix them with water and use them to cleanse those things. So we see here, beginning of verse 11, he who touches a corpse of any person shall be unclean for 7 days. And it's the water, verse 12, will purify himself from uncleanliness with the water on the third day. This water that's been mixed with ashes of the red heifer. What does this sound like to you, by the way? A special water to cleanse things. Exorcisms? Exorcist? Anybody? It's 'tis the season for that, right? So it is, yes. So it's what God has prescribed here, but it sounds an awful lot like holy water, right? Is that what it sounds like? Where did holy water come from? Here's where holy water came from. All right, they didn't have ashes of the red heifer or anything like that, but that's that concept. So you see these like Old Testament kind of priestly things being brought over into Catholicism and added to Catholicism. This is kind of where that idea probably came from. And so again, used to cleanse things. And so we're using that for those who have come in contact with the dead body or anyone who touches a corpse. Let's say verse 14. You go to sleep, you and your family in our tent, and you wake up and Uncle Cletus is dead in the tent. What do you do? Verse 14 says what? This is the law when a man dies in a tent. Everyone who comes into the tent and everyone who is in the tent shall be unclean 7 days. Every open vessel, which is no covering tied down on it, shall be unclean. Also, anyone who is in the open field and touches one who has been slain with a sword, or has died of naturally, or a man, anyone, any human bone or a grave shall be unclean for 7 days. So you see what's going on here? And then, dun-dun-dun, ashes of the red heifer help in that cleansing process as part of what's going to be used. Verse 17, then the unclean person, they shall take some of the ashes of the burnt purification from sin, and flowing water shall be added to them in a vessel. And the clean person shall take hyssop, dip it in the water. This hyssop is like a grass or something that you use to think of like a grass that's used for brooms and that kind of stuff. That kind of thing. You take hyssop and then you sprinkle it on the tent, on the furnishings, on the persons who were there, on the one who touched the bone or the slain man. Then the clean person shall Then the clean person shall sprinkle on the unclean on the third day and on the seventh day. All the cleans and uncleans get confusing from sometimes. And then that person that did these things, that touched the ashes, have to wash their clothes and they're unclean until the evening. And the one that was clean, that purified the people, they're unclean until the evening. And this, verse 21, a phrase we see over and over and over again in this book. So it shall be a perpetual statute for them. Which means what? Until God says otherwise, this is how we're going to do this. This is the prescription for, you know, if somebody dies in your tent, right? Or if you come into contact with these things. And so, 22, furthermore, anything that the unclean person touches shall be unclean, and the person who touches it shall be unclean until evening. This, incidentally, is kind of interesting. Those that are have leprosy, those are the lepers, are unclean in this way too. Like they can cause somebody else to be unclean. And so they were seen as people who were walking around as dead men's bones, right? They were a person that could contaminate other people. And so they might be walking through the streets unclean. And you see this idea of, well, we got to stay away from anybody who is unclean because I want to be holy and clean and pure at all times. And so this is where that contamination tracking. This is the original cross-contamination tracking that was kind of going down. Well, what did you touch? When did you touch it? Are you unclean or not unclean? And so we start tracking those kind of things down. All right, chapter 20. Going into chapter 20, we start this next section, the last chapters here of this book. And the new generation of Israelites began to attempt to enter the land, and so we see Balak trying to use Balaam. People dying because of disobedience, and so there's a lot of death still to take place in this book. And then we have a changing of hats, changing of guards, kind of at the end of the book of Numbers, and a renumbering as well. So we numbered as we went into the desert, and we started our trek. And then after all these generations have passed, we number again. Where are we now that, you know, this generation has died? So we see that in the rest of this book. And in chapter 20 starts off, we have the death of Miriam. Two verses that covers the death of Miriam. The sons of Israel and the whole congregation came to the wilderness of Zin in the first month, and the people stayed at Kadesh. Now Miriam died there and was buried there. One sentence with Miriam. And then verse 2, we begin the story about the incident with the waters at Meribah. Now remember, we talked about places that are named. If they go to a place that becomes named because of what happened there, it generally wasn't good, right? So this is another one of those instances where they came into an area and something went down and it wasn't good. There was no water for the congregation, and they assembled themselves against Moses and Aaron, which is what I don't understand when, you know, water, things aren't going great. In other times, God has provided water for them. In other situations, God has taken care of them. And now all of a sudden, we're gonna be up in arms because there's no water here. Why don't they just like come to Moses and say, hey, by the way, there's no water. Do you mind, you know, turning the spigot on for us, right? Just talk to God and let's get some water going. Why be all angry about it? That's what I don't get necessarily. But, you know, you do lots of things when you're really thirsty, I guess. But the people thus contended with Moses, saying, if only we had perished when our brothers perished before the Lord. What are they talking about? When did we just talk about a lot of people dying before the Lord? 250 men died right in front of the tent. A bunch of families were swallowed up by the ground. Do you remember that? The rebellion of Korah, which becomes sort of a byword. You know, that rebellion becomes a byword even in the New Testament about rebellion. It's like, oh, if we had just died, right? This is like Scarlett O'Hara kind of stuff here with this. Why then have you brought this wilderness, this Lord's assembly into the wilderness for us and our beasts to die here? Why have you made us to come up from Egypt to bring us into this wretched place? It is not a place of grain or figs or vines or pomegranates, nor is there water to drink. And then Moses and Aaron fall on their faces before the Lord. And what does the Lord prescribe? What does the Lord say that Moses is supposed to do? Verse 8. What is he supposed to do? What is he supposed to do? Speak to the rock, right? Yes, to speak to the rock. Now, there was a time when he did hit the rock. All right, if you go back to Exodus, this is the rod that he's using for signs, Exodus 4:17. And then 17:5-7, we have a strike the rock moment there. And so if you want to fill that in there, Exodus 17:5-7 was another moment when something similar happened. But God told him to speak, just talk to it. And, you know, water's going to come out. So Moses took the rod from before the Lord, just as he had commanded him. And Moses and Aaron gathered the assembly before the rock, this particular rock, and they said to them, listen now, you rebels. Shall we bring forth water for you out of this rock? What changed here? And then what did he end up doing? Then Moses lifted up his hand and struck the rock twice with his rod, and the water came forth abundantly, and the congregation and their beasts drank. What was different here? What did Moses do differently? There is some credit here. Should we? And he included Aaron in on this gig. Should we do this? Should we bring this water forth for you? Immediately, God kind of says something to him. Because you have not believed me to treat me as holy in the sight of the sons of Israel, therefore you shall not bring this assembly into the land which I have given them. Those were the waters of Meribah. And so contention is what that is translated as. Because the sons of Israel contended with the Lord, and he proved himself holy among them. God was still holy and did what he needed to do, despite what others had done. But they were not holy in what they were doing. And so we have this, the waters of Meribah, and the contention there. Now, they are traveling around a lot, and they're not in a situation where they're traveling to where they're just kind of wandering around, and they never come in contact with other peoples. They come in contact with other peoples, and this is one of those scenarios with Edom, the Edomites. Does anybody know where the Edomites come from? Not from a land down under. Where do they come from? Yes, for the descendants of Esau, right? If you want to write out here Genesis chapter 25:23 and Genesis 36:1, where's the Edomites? And so they are, you know, distant kin. They could go to the same family reunions together. So they go before, so from Kadesh, Moses sent messengers to the king of Edom. Thus your brother Israel has said. That is why that's important to note the, you know, where they came from. And it says, you know all our hardship that's been following us. Talks about what's going on. And he said, hey, just let us, verse 17, please let us pass through your land. We will not pass through field or throughout your vineyard. We will not even drink water from a well. We will go along the king's highway, not turning to the right or to the left. So that king's highway is just kind of off the coast, going straight up towards Canaan. So there ends what's kind of like the area. If you draw a straight line in your Bible's maps from the Dead Sea, the bottom of the Dead Sea, straight down to the Red Sea, that finger of the Red Sea, and then a line over to the coast, that area, that little triangle area, is the Negev, or the desert. And they were kind of in the northern part of that area, and they were going to just go travel right up the coast towards Canaan and maybe attack Canaan from the coast that direction, right? And we don't know, but they asked permission to go through there, and they were not given it. They were not given it. And so Edom says no. Edom, however, said to him, you shall not pass through us, or I will come out with a sword against you. And so then he said, you shall not pass through. And Edom came out against him with a heavy force and with a strong hand. And thus Edom refused to allow Israel to pass through its territory. This will not be the only time that Edom tries to do something against Israel. It happens many times in the future as well. So now we have the death of Aaron. And we have a little bit more information here with the death of Aaron. So the Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron at Mount Hor and the border of the land of Edom, saying, Aaron will be gathered to his people, for he shall not enter the land which I have chosen to the sons of Israel, because you rebelled against me, my command, at the waters of Meribah. So Aaron was also included in that rebellion. And also included in that. And so there is, basically, Aaron is taken up on the mountain with Eleazar, and they go up on top of the mountain with Moses. His garments are taken off of him. They are put on his son Eleazar. And as soon as that happens, Aaron died there on the mountaintop. So when that kind of, when the mantle was sort of passed to Eleazar, Aaron died right there on the mountain. And the text tells us in verse 29 that all the house of Israel wept for Aaron 30 days there for his death. And so we see that passing from one to another in chapter 20. Questions, comments? Chapter 21, we have the conquering of Arad. And here are some people who did some things they shouldn't have. Have you ever done something and afterwards you're like, I probably shouldn't have done that? Like maybe some of us daily, right? I don't know. But so here's a situation where here's the Canaanite, the king of Arad, who lived in the Negev, again, that area we're talking about, heard that Israel was coming by the way of Ethraim, which could be translated by the way of his spies. He heard about what was going on, depending on the translation. And then he fought against Israel and took some of them captive. And so Israel made a vow to the Lord and said, if you will indeed deliver this people into my hand, then I will utterly destroy their cities. And guess what? They did that. They destroyed that area. And that place was called Hormah, which is devoted to destruction, is the name of that area. Which, I mean, that's not a name of a town you want, right? So they destroyed all those things in those first three verses. And then we have the bronze serpent comes onto the scene. Verse 4, then they set out from Mount Hor by the way of the Red Sea to go around the land of Edom, and the people became impatient because of the journey. Again, this concept. Are we there yet? Just the complaining. I don't like people who whine and complain, just like nails on a chalkboard. And I could imagine being around like hundreds of thousands of people who are doing that and are complaining. And so we have this situation. And not only that, the people spoke against God and Moses. Why have you brought us up out of Egypt to die in the wilderness? So dramatic. For there is no food, no water, and we loathe this miserable food. They want to go back to Egypt where they have leeks and all these fruits and vegetables and all these different things, and we want to go back and eat the fishes and all this kind of stuff. It was the belly, right? There's just like maybe a group mentality, because early on when they're first out, we look early on in Numbers, There are a group of what is called rebels with them, a group of people who are not actually Israelites, that left out of Egypt with them. It's possible they kind of stir the pot on some of these things. That is possible. Anyway, they're saying it here. And when they say, "We loathe this miserable food," what are they making reference to? That God supplies for them all the time? Manna. Now, I've eaten something for a full 2 weeks, and I have vowed in my life that I'll never eat it again. And so I understand, right? Maybe it gets to that point. But when you're in survival mode, it's a little bit different. It's different than you're wondering what this is. It was Cocoa Puff cereal. I will never eat Cocoa Puff cereal ever again. But this is a little bit different, right? It's a little bit different. But they're complaining against God. I think that was like strike one. That we shouldn't be doing that. And so what does God do? What's that? We got serpents. The Lord sent fiery serpents. Which, are they serpents that are literally on fire? Or are they serpents that when you get bit by them, it feels like fire? The world may never know. But fiery serpents go into the people and begin biting them. And then they change their tune, verse 7. What do they say in verse 7? "We sinned. Sorry, we forgot. We forgot all these things that you would do, that you'd be serious about stuff. We've spoken against the Lord and against you." What do they ask here in verse 7? What is their ask? Take it away. But there's an interesting word that's used here. In my text, it says, "Intercede with the Lord that he may remove the serpents from us." And Moses interceded for the people. Why is that important? Intercession. Oh, hey. All right, Jesus. So later on, we're going to have a prophet like unto Moses, right? That is brought up. If you want to write out here, Romans chapter 8, verse 34. Romans 8, 34. Also, Hebrews chapter 7, 24 through 25. We have a high priest who ever lives to make intercession for us. There's interesting little things you learn about. So here's Moses, the shadow of things to come. And so there's some things we can learn here. So they asked for an intercessor. Did you know what Job asked for that he never really got? You know Job wanted an intercessor? If only I had somebody to talk to God on my behalf. He wanted an intercessor. Here's a blessing that we have in Christ, that intercessor. And so we see that Moses intercedes. And so Moses, the Lord says to Moses, "Make a fiery serpent, set it on a standard. It shall come about that everyone who is bitten and looks at it will live." And Moses made a bronze serpent and set it on a standard. And it came about that if a serpent bit any man, when he looked on the bronze serpent, he lived. If you want to write out here, John 3:14, but there's this idea there that that Christ is kind of an image of something raised up. What's interesting about this bronze serpent, it hung around for a while. It hung around for a while. Anybody remember about the date of the Exodus-ish? What's the date of the Exodus? Do you remember? Was it 14? Dan, was it 14? The date of the Exodus-ish? I thought it was 14. Anyway, about 1400 B.C., 1403 or some of that. So around the 1400s is when this was made. It was 700 plus B.C. Or less than 700. We're going counting backwards. 600 and something when the fiery serpent was actually destroyed. Guess who destroyed it? King Hezekiah destroyed this fiery serpent. It had hung around. If you want to write out here, 2 Kings chapter 18, verses 3 and 4. It had hung around for a long time. And 2 Kings tells us that it was worshipped, they offered incense to it, and they called it Nehushtan. And they gave it a name, and they worshipped it. And you wonder why God has not left the Holy Grail, he hasn't left any of the stuff that we, man, would have worshipped later on, right? We're not leaving any of those things. I'm not leaving the temple. I'm not leaving anything. There are no relics that you can say were from that time, because mankind is going to do this and take something and then worship it as an idol. We already do that with other things that aren't even holy, much less something that we might have thought would have been holy at some point. And so fiery serpent happens, and they learn a lesson, hopefully, for a short period of time. 10 through 20, we have a record of movements, where they're going from different places, different places, and there's different places that are mentioned. Incidentally, you'll see every once in a while this mention of a wadi. Do you know what a wadi is? A wadi. Way down yonder on the wadi. It's basically a washout from like a dry creek bed, where you'll see like a dry creek bed coming down the side of a mountain, and it kind of just fades out into this big open area that only is there when it rains or flash floods and that kind of stuff. That is a wadi. And so it mentions several of those where they're camping. It's a geological formation. That was free for you tonight. That was an extra little piece of information. You can use it in maybe some useless trivia game or something. I don't know. But so we have these different places where they are. We'll actually recover all these later on in the book, so we won't go through them right now. But we get a couple of victories. It's always good to have a victory, right? Everybody loves a victory. Everybody loves a win. Israel sent messengers to Sihon, king of Amorite, saying, "Let me pass through your land." And Sihon, verse 23, said, "I will not permit you to pass through my land." And so they came out and fought, verse 23, and came to Jahaz and fought against Israel. Then Israel struck him with the edge of the sword and took possession of his land from the Arnon to the Jabbok, as far as the sons of Ammon, to the border of the sons of Ammon and Jezir. And Israel took all of these cities, and Israel lived in these cities. What? They actually got to take possession of some of these cities and live in them. Could you imagine? Like, oh, finally, I'm in a house, right? After being in a tent. How many of you have been camping and you finally get home and you're like, oh, my own bed, right? So maybe they're in maybe a little comfortable scenario. They don't stay here. But as they conquered them, they stayed in their cities for a time and they moved on. And so they took up residence there. And verse 31 says, "Thus Israel lived in the land of the Amorites, and Moses sent a spy to Jazer, and they captured its villages and deposed these Amorites as well." So they basically just wiped the map of the Amorites and get rid of them. And then they turned, verse 33, and went up to Bashan, and Og, the king of Bashan, and went out with all his people for battle. But the Lord said to Moses, "Do not fear them, for I have given them into your hand, and shall be like you did with the Amorites." In verse 35, so they killed them and his sons and all his people until there was no remnant left. They killed them until they were dead, and they possessed his land. So they killed them until they died of it, and everybody was gone, and they possessed that land. Now, what does this do for the people? We're getting some victories now. We're getting some notches in our belt. Some things are happening. What do you think we're preparing this people for? Now, had these people not made the choices, they didn't have to necessarily fight, but what is this doing for the people of Israel? What do you think? We're getting prepared, right? We're practicing our troop movements. We are understanding our relationship with God, that when God says we're going to have victory, we are going to have victory. We're going to be victorious. And I'm sorry? There's a confidence, right? Confidence in God, that he's providing for them, and that this is going to happen. And so we see this happen here in this section. Now, we see chapter 22. Balak is understanding everything that's going on and has all these people. Balak says to Balaam that there's people that just covers the land that are coming through here. They just cover the land. And he's afraid that they're gonna do to him what was done, you know, to others. And so what does he say he asked for them to go over to Balaam and to come back. And please come, in verse 6, "Please come and curse this people for me, since they are too mighty for me," is what he says in verse 6. He says, "For I know that he whom you bless is blessed, and he whom you curse is cursed. So Balaam is a person who has is a priest of some sort for God, or a prophet for in some manner for God. He is not obviously under any kind of Levitical covenant at all. Much like Jethro was a worshiper of God as well, Melchizedek was. There are other people who were worshipers of God that were not under that Levitical covenant, that were not under that Mosaic covenant. And so he's out from underneath that, but these other people recognize that, you know, whatever he says happens, and so they send for him. And verse 7 it says, so the elders of Moab and the elders of Midian, Moab and Midian, departed with the fees for divination in their hand. So they go out there to pay him to come back, to curse this people. And what happens? Do you know all this? What happens? They get to Balaam in verse 8, and Balaam says, hey, chill, let me go talk to God and see what he says. What does God say? What's that? Don't go, right? Balaam, don't go. Don't go, right? Behold, there's a people who has come out of Egypt, and they cover the surface of the land. Now come and curse them, is what he asked for. And God says, do not go with them. You shall not curse a people, for they are blessed. And so Balak goes out and says, go back to your, Balaam goes out and says, go back to your land, for the Lord has refused to let me go with you. And they go back, and they tell Balak, he said no. And he said, no, he's not coming. Well, he sends more stuff out to him, right? So you've got to come. You've got to come. The pressure cell. And they go back out to him. And Balaam replies to the servants, though Balak were to give me his house full of silver and gold, I could not do anything, either small or great, contrary to the command of the Lord my God. But he says, wait, now please, I'll go ask one more time. How many of you have had children that you've said no? No, we're not doing this. But they come up to you and say one more time, maybe please, can we do this? Do you know they really want to do this thing? It's obvious, right? They keep asking. If Balaam was content with God's no, would he have even gone and asked again? No. Excellent. Very good answer. No. And so he would not have gone and asked again, but he went and asked again. I think in my mind, the text does not say this, but he sees all the shiny things they're bringing to him, right? And he maybe wants those things. Maybe I'll go ask and see if God changes his mind. But God came to him and said, if the men have come to call you, raise up and go with them, but only the word which I speak to you shall do. So Balaam rose and went the next morning. But God was still angry with them. This was not what he wanted him to do, verse 22, right? And we know he is angry, because what did the donkey keep saying? What did the donkey keep saying? What's the donkey seeing that Balaam can't see? The angel of the Lord. What does a donkey see that Balaam can't? God is not happy with your choice. The donkey knew that. There's a lesson there. So the donkey was moving out of the way, and he gets angry at the donkey every time the donkey does something and he gets hit. And then when the donkey saw the angel, verse 27, she lay down under Balaam. So Balaam was angry and struck the donkey with his stick. And the Lord opened the mouth of the donkey, and she said to him, what have I done to you that you've struck me these three times? You know what Balaam did? He didn't pass out. He didn't gasp. He argued with the donkey. I don't know how many talking animals you have seen that were not connected with Disney in some way. But here, because you have made a mockery of me, if there had been a sword in my hand, I would have killed you by now. He's arguing with a donkey. I just, you know, stop and think here a bit. Am I not your donkey? this is fun. I love this conversation here. Verse 30, the donkey said to Balaam, am I not your donkey? And what you have ridden all your life, I have been a good burro. Have I ever been accustomed to do so to you? I have been a good donkey, right? Why would I do this to you? It is a little bit. I wasn't going to say that. That'll do, right? Okay. So then the Lord opened the eyes of Balaam and he saw what was going on. And then the angel of the Lord said, why have you struck your donkey? Like, it's weird that you're fighting against your donkey. I've come out as an adversary because your way is contrary to me. The donkey saw and turned aside these three times. If she had not, I would have surely killed you. Balaam said, I have sinned, for I did not know. And so God is letting him know. He's not 100% pleased. God is not pleased with what Balaam is doing. But the angel of the Lord says, go with them, but only speak what God is commanded you to speak. Three times in verse 23, or chapter 23 rather, three times we have this blessing. Balak takes him up on a high place. There's seven altars, seven things die. So I sacrifice to God. Balaam says only what God can tell him to say. And so he blesses them every single time. And he blesses them from up on the mountain. And then Balak, every single time afterwards, is mad. Verse 11, after they had blessed the people, he says, then Balak said to Balaam, what have you done to me? I look to you to curse my enemies, but behold, you have actually blessed them. And that's when Balaam says, I told you, I could only say what I was commanded to say. And then let's go to another place. And they go to another place. And they do the same kind of ritual at another place where they can see the people and he can use his cursing powers. Hopefully, this is what Balak is wanting. He can actually see them and use his cursing powers and curse them. And then what happens? Second time. Does he curse them? We're not taking the time to read all of this, but it's very plain that he does not curse them, right? He blesses them again. He tells them about blessings that are going to happen to them. Then Balak said to Balaam, do not curse them at all, nor bless them. Don't say anything. You're making a mess of this. And then again, Balaam says, did I not tell you this is going to happen? I tell you, and I tell you these things, but you don't listen. And then verse 27, we start this process over again. Then Balak said to Balaam, please come, and I will take you to another place. Perhaps it will be agreeable with God that you will curse them from there. This guy is really persistent. He wants them cursed. And he knows if you're going to curse a thing, you got to use Balaam, right? You got to curse him good. And so they go to another place. And then there in verse 2 of chapter 24, we see this third blessing. And it says the Spirit of God came upon him this third time and took up his discourse and said, the oracle of Balaam, the son of Beor, the oracle of the man whose eyes opened, the oracle of him who hears the words of God, who sees the vision of the Almighty, falling down and having eyes uncovered. How fair are your tents, O Jacob, your dwellings, O Israel, like valleys that stretch out. And then you go through this blessing of these people, right? And then talking about how powerful they're going to be with God and fighting against their enemies. And the whole time, Balak's like, no, that's not what I want you to do. You just see Balak just steaming with anger. In verse 10, Balak's anger burned against Balaam, and he struck his hands together. And Balak said to Balaam, I called you to curse my enemies, but behold, you have persisted in blessing them these three times. Therefore, flee to your place now. I said I would honor you greatly, but behold, the Lord has held you back from honor. Here's what evil does, right? Evil says, God's keeping you from doing all the fun things. God's keeping you from doing the things that you should do. God's keeping you from all these blessings. They're speaking from a place of ignorance, right? God has kept him from dying, right? God has kept them from more than what this person can understand. And God has blessed Balaam more than what he can understand. Now, Balaam becomes a byword of one who's disobedient to God because he went through this process. But this is how evil talks to those who are righteous. God's keeping you from doing all these different things. That's not really actually the case at all. We will finish there tonight and pick up in 2 weeks. Thank you very much for your time tonight.